What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 82. This is Keto for Cancer Part 2. On last week's podcast, we talked about the evolutionary argument for why the new way of living and eating has caused cancer, obviously on a grain-heavy diet, and why the metabolic theory of cancer kind of gets, I don't know, the short end of the stick, probably for money reasons. So if you want to listen to that, check out next week's podcast. On this week, we're going to talk about something called the retrograde response and kind of go a little bit more into the science of why cancer cells love sugar and why a ketogenic diet can help reduce your odds of getting cancer. So yeah, we're not going to have a what's new this week. I wanted just to get the ball started right away on, just get this flow started. So if you listen to last week's podcast, you can just start this one and go right into it without any sort of delay. So that sounds good?
Yeah, I'm just training for my next marathon. Nothing special.
Yeah, got it. So with that in mind, let's talk about the retrograde response, which is going to be the huge point of this entire podcast. So cancer cells love sugar. We've established that. But why and how do they start taking up more sugar in the first place? This is called a retrograde response. So in response to some injury or stress, the cell can no longer produce enough energy through aerobic respiration to maintain a healthy cell. Each cell has a budget of about negative 56 kilojoules per mole of energy needed to be produced in order to maintain life. When that gets compromised, the mitochondria sends a message to the nucleus that says, hey, we're struggling over here, we need help producing more energy. Why don't you start producing some proteins and enzymes needed to increase the amount of glucose we can burn? That way we can hit our ATP goal. And the nucleus goes, okay, cool, I'll start doing that. And this is the trigger that initiates all the bad stuff. It's these cells that are able to successfully activate the retrograde response that actually have the potential to turn cancerous. So the retrograde response sets the stage for cancer. And it's called, I guess just the little details on why it's called a retrograde response, because the way our cells normally work is the nucleus is like the brain, and the nucleus kind of dictates what's going on in the entire cell. But the mitochondria has a unique capability of kind of talking back to the nucleus and telling the nucleus what to do. No other like organelle, no other little system in our cell is going to be able to do that. But the mitochondria is so important that it can actually do that. It can talk back to the nucleus, which is kind of a unique trait.
And there's also hundreds, maybe even thousands of mitochondria in a cell.
Yeah.
So like it needs to be able to have that communication going on. Mm-hmm. Because if you wait for the nucleus to tell all the mitochondria what to do, I mean, that's just going to take forever.
Yeah. And then by the time it happens, the cell is going to be too compromised to survive any sort of damage that occurs.
Yeah, and like we talked about last week, how every cell wants to live. So this is a response so it can live.
Yes, exactly. To the most basic point, that's exactly right. So the retrograde response sets the stage for cancer. It increases the amount of glucose the cell uses. It decreases the amount of healthy aerobic respiration. And in the process, changes the genes active in the nucleus. This response turns on genes that make the cell love to grow and hate to die. Things like mTOR get activated and IGF-1, which are both metabolic pathways that promote growth and inhibit death. And that's a cancer cell. A cancer cell will try and grow and never die. So remember, we have checks and balances in place to keep our cells in check. We have tumor suppression genes like P53, we talked about that last week, that promote something called apoptosis, or apoptosis, however the hell you want to pronounce it, program, which is this programmed cell suicide. When one of our cells gets out of line or becomes too broken for repair, this is how our body cleans it up. This gene encodes for proteins, P53, that are required for apoptosis to occur. When our cellular metabolism becomes dysfunctional, this gene works less efficiently, which is not a good thing. Now this dysfunctional cell has turned on genes that promote sugar intake to reach that magic number of negative 56 kilojoules per mole to maintain life, and proteins that promote growth and not death. So the signal to die is diminished, and the signal to grow is heightened, which is not a good thing. That's, you know, that's cancer 101 right there. Here's a quote outlining what the retrograde response is trying to do. Quote, "The primary role of the retrograde response is to coordinate the synthesis of ATP through glycolysis alone or through a combination of glycolysis and glutaminolysis when respiratory function is impaired. The retrograde response would be essential for maintaining a stable energy for cell viability during periods when respiration is impaired," end quote. So the retrograde response can be a good thing if the cell can repair the injury that hampered aerobic respiration and then turn off the retrograde response and get back to normal work. But just think about how people eat and live their lives. They eat highly processed foods all day and sit on their asses. Their cells and mitochondria get damaged, and when their cells try to heal themselves, most people don't all of a sudden change their diet and lifestyle. They keep doing the same thing they were doing to cause the damage in the first place, therefore never giving their body an actual chance to heal. This will chronically activate the retrograde response and can lead to cancer. And you know, we see that all the time. That's just what it is.
Yeah, and you were talking about how mTOR and IGF-1, they're growth factors, and those are activated. So when you're growing, you're not repairing. Like, those are two kind of counterintuitive things.
Yeah.
Like, you're growing, you're building new things. You're not worried about having to tear down old things and make sure that they're working properly. And since these growth factors are activated, that's when angiogenesis, the growth of new blood vessels, that also increases. So now there's a greater blood supply. That's another characteristic of cancer. There's a greater blood supply going to these cancer cells to give them more glutamine, more glucose. So they're able to intake more and more to keep that energy balance going on.
Yep, exactly.
So that's a negative in multiple factors.
Yes, 100%. It's making them grow, it's making them more supply, making them inhibit death, all bad stuff. So here's a quote about that. Quote, "The retrograde response would be essential for maintaining a stable delta G, that's that negative 56 number, for cell viability during periods when respiration is impaired. A prolonged retrograde response, however, would leave the nuclear genome vulnerable to instability and mutability. Considered collectively, these observations suggest that the bulk of the genetic abnormalities found in cancer cells, ranging from point mutations to gross chromosomal rearrangements, can arise following damage to the structure and function of mitochondria. This is the situation in most tumor cells. Only those body cells able to increase glycolysis during intermittent respiratory damage were considered capable of forming cancers. Cells unable to elevate glycolysis in response to respiratory insults, on the other hand, would perish due to energy failure. Cancer cells would therefore arise from normal body cells through a gradual and irreversible damage to their respiratory capacity. Aerobic glycolysis arising from damaged respiration is the single most common phenotype found in all cancer," end quote. Boom, that's it. I know it's a long-ass quote, but aerobic respiration is damaged, and now the cell is forced to get energy from glucose. That's the problem.
And how there's that gene theory, how it's mutated DNA that turns into cancer. No, it's the opposite. It's that the mitochondria is damaged, and that leads to a ton of mutations. It's the mitochondria damaged first, and that leads to all the mutations. That's why you see there is no pattern of mutations. They're just all over the place. There's a ton of them, because all that's being caused by all the damage. That's a downstream effect of the damaged mitochondria.
Yeah, we're not saying that gene mutations don't happen.
No, they do. They happen at an alarming rate. And
it causes damage, and it sucks.
And we even talk about that in, I think it's a Cleaner Fuel podcast. When glycolysis is going on, that's why we don't want it occurring all the time. We're more susceptible to DNA damage.
Yep.
What's going on here? A shit ton of DNA damage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So remember, healthy cells normally don't get their energy from glycolysis. Normally, they produce most of their energy through aerobic respiration. So in cells with functional mitochondria, energy is derived mostly from aerobic respiration, where approximately 88% of total cellular energy is produced. And when a cell activates a retrograde response, this number will literally inverse over time. So because remember, there's a budget that the cell has to pay. It has to pay rent or it's getting evicted. This rent is called the delta G of ATP. And it basically means, you know, the cell has to produce a certain amount of ATP just to live. And here's a quote about that. Quote, the consistency of the delta G of ATP of approximately negative 56 kilojoules per mole is fundamental to cellular homeostasis, and its relationship to cancer cell energy is pivotal. The maintenance of the delta G of ATP is the endpoint of both genetic and metabolic processes, and any disturbance in this energy level will compromise cell function and viability. Cells can die from either too little or too much energy, end quote. And I think this is, we talked about in part one, Thomas Seyfried is really the inspiration for a lot of this stuff. And this is such a, and again, I feel like this is a point you would make. It's like such a basic thing. Like, this is the number our cell has to hit.
If you can't pay rent, you get evicted. Like, that's what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to go on that last part of that quote, cells can die from either too little or too much energy. The too much energy is going to come up, I think, either at the end of this podcast or maybe episode three. I'm not sure. But it's such a beautiful thing. I don't know. It just, this, the researching this and this little number made cancer so much more understanding to me. Or understandable, I should say.
Yeah, and we were just talking about how it goes from 88% of aerobic, which is basically very energy, like we're producing a lot
efficient.
Of it. Yeah, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. Energy efficient to 88% glycolysis, which is very inefficient. That's why you see a lot of people with cancer lose a ton of weight.
Yeah.
It's because they're just using so much energy. They're burning through so much energy. So they're going through all their stores. They're running through all their fat stores, their muscle stores. They're in a very energy deficient or dysfunctional standpoint, so they have to use whatever they have available.
Yeah, you're never going to see a jack dude with, you know, stage 4 cancer. You know what I'm saying? It's just not going to work. So after the retrograde response is activated, the cell will take up 88% of its energy from glycolysis and 12% from aerobic respiration, with the goal of maintaining that number, the negative 56 kilojoules per mole. Some aerobic respiration capacity is left. Not every single electron transfer chain in the cell will be damaged beyond the point of no return. There are hundreds of mitochondria in the cells and hundreds of thousands of electron transport chains in each mitochondria, but there's not enough healthy electron transport chains to produce enough energy to keep the cell alive. And that's a key point, because the electron transport chain is where aerobic respiration occurs. So what about all the gene mutation everyone talks about with cancer? Like, when do those happen? All the things do happen, like we said, but they happen after the metabolism is broken. The retrograde response leaves the nucleus in a vulnerable position and can cause damage to it if it's left on for too long. And here's a quote talking about that. Quote, considered collectively, these findings indicate that the integrity of the nuclear genome is dependent to a large extent on the functionality and energy production of the mitochondria. Most human cancer cells display genome instability involving elevated mutation rates, gross chromosomal rearrangements, and alterations in chromosome number. The recent studies of the Singh group provided compelling evidence that mitochondrial dysfunction operating largely through the retrograde response can underlie the mutator phenotype of tumor cells. End quote. So pretty much all that's saying is that all these mutations do happen, but they happen in response to the retrograde response, not the other way around. So an effective treatment would be focusing on the retrograde response and respiration of the cell, not the mutations. Because like Tom said, there's no pattern. So what's the point?
Yeah, you can spend all the time, all the money in the world, and you're not going to find a pattern because it doesn't exist. Yeah. And luckily, there is a drug that's targeted at this. Unfortunately, it doesn't have the funding. It hasn't gone through the rigorous testing, but it has been tested in like several, I think like a handful of cases.
Yeah.
And it works really well. It's called 3BP. The doctor's name is Young Hee Ko. She's South Korean. I'm sorry, I'm probably butchering that name.
For sure.
And that attacks the whole glycolysis. It inhibits it. So now the negative 56 kilojoules, that rent payment that's due, now since glycolysis is inhibited, it's no longer able to produce enough energy. And without that functional mitochondria, which cancer cells do not have, it can't make up the energy in another way. So that energy balance isn't there anymore. The cell is no longer paying any rent. It gets evicted.
Yes.
And so all those cells die. One of the biggest problems with this treatment is that it's too powerful because it kills all the cells. So yeah. Now you got to worry about like...
all the cancer cells.
Yeah. It kills all the cancer cells, but any healthy cell, it does not attach. It does not damage because they have functional mitochondria.
And they're not relying on glycolysis.
Yeah. So it's a perfect treatment. But the only downside of it is that it kills so many cancer cells at such a fast rate that there's a lot of ammonia buildup. But again, this is only damaging cancer cells. Your healthy cells are perfectly fine. This is unlike chemotherapy. This is unlike radiation therapy, where all the cells are getting targeted. No, this is only targeting your damaged cells, your cancerous cells. So this should be researched a lot more, and unfortunately, it's not.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. So if you want to learn more about this, there's a book called Tripping Over the Truth, which Tom just recently, he's very passionate about this because he just re-listened to it for this podcast.
I think like the fourth or fifth time. Like, yeah. I was super upset when I figured out about this like the first time around.
Yeah.
And just going over it again and again, it's like, damn, man, like, why are we not researching this?
Yeah, no, it's very frustrating. And I haven't listened to it again just because, I don't know, I'm like...
You're going to punch the steering wheel or the windshield.
Yeah,
your
it's
car.
Not a good like, thing for me. Yeah, I'll get too emotional. It really does frustrate me talking about this stuff and just all the corruption involved and how people's health are really just being taken advantage of for profit. You know what I mean? Like, how rich do you need to be, bro? These like pharmaceutical companies are swimming in money.
I mean, it's either that or they just don't think it could be this simple. Like that it can't be genetic. Or, I mean, it can't be a metabolic disease. But yeah, there's a treatment out there that works amazing. It works maybe too well, and now you have this like ammonia, which is basically like protein poisoning.
Yeah,
you have to give the patient treatment to like to deal with all that excess ammonia so they can excrete it faster.
Yeah,
in fact, that's one thing you need to do with that. It is getting tested in other countries, not so much here. I think it was a German patient was like the first one that they tested it on. They tested it on a patient in Egypt and some other countries, like either in Europe or just like the Middle East, that area. So it is getting tested. Unfortunately, we're behind the eight ball on this.
America always is, bro.
I believe she's in California, or I know she has been in the U.S. for quite a while.
Okay.
So, I don't know why we're not taking advantage of one of the smartest people out there.
Because there's no money in cures. There's only money in treatment of symptoms.
Yeah, I hope it's not that cynical, but it could be.
Yeah, I know. I really think it is. So, okay, so that's a retrograde response, and that's how the cell kind of increases its the amount of glucose it has access to and sets the stage for cancer pretty much. So if we cut out sugar, then we're good, right? Like that's really the end goal here.
Well, actually, before we move on, so we were just talking about how we have all those growth factors activated, mTOR and IGF-1. So another issue with that is why those things are elevated all the time. High carb diets, that's what activates those.
Yes.
And if those are activated, things like autophagy, which is cellular repair, basically breakdown of old damaged cells, does not occur. So that's another reason why this stuff is happening. Not only are we doing excessive damage through all these mutations, but then we're no longer giving our body the signals to deal with those mutations, to deal with that damage. So it's a 1-2 combo.
That's just
giving your body cancer.
100%. Yeah, when we talk about IGF-1, that signal is insulin. And our hormone, or the hormone that's in like, response to carbohydrates is insulin. That's what our body produces when we eat carbs. So that sets the whole stage for all this stuff. And mTOR as well. And there's actually a lot more growth factors that are activated during cancer. It's just, if I would say them all, no one would listen. You know
what I'm saying? Those are the two main ones that most people know about.
Yeah.
And I know protein, especially animal protein, gets associated with especially mTOR.
mTOR, yeah.
But sugar and carbohydrates activate it so much more.
And so much longer.
Yeah. And your body needs protein. Your body does not need sugar and carbs.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's obviously, what's the logical one? You consume the one that does less damage and is more useful.
And required. And,
yeah. You eliminate the one that is causes more damage and you don't really need.
Yep. Oh, yeah. That's such a great point. Exactly.
Okay, so now on to the next part.
Yeah, on to the next part, yeah. So you cut out sugar and we're good. It's like, no, sorry, cancer is more of a beast than that. So it can also run off the amino acid glutamine as a fuel source through substrate-level phosphorylation. And here's a quote about that. So, quote, besides glucose, glutamine can also serve as a major energy metabolite for some cancers. Cell viability and growth can be maintained from energy generated through substrate-level phosphorylation in the TCA cycle using glutamine as a substrate. Energy obtained through this pathway could give the false impression of normal oxidative phosphorylation as oxygen consumption and CO2 production can arise from glutaminolysis and uncoupled oxidative phosphorylation. Hence, evidence suggesting that mitochondrial function is normal in cancer cells should be considered with caution unless data are provided which exclude substrate level phosphorylation through glutaminolysis or glycolysis as alternate cell sources of energy, end quote. And this is one of the arguments against Seyfried is that there are some markers for, I guess, normal aerobic respiration, normal mitochondrial function in cancer cells. And this is his argument kind of against that, that it's not really true.
But there could, yeah, like you just mentioned, it could be either glutamine, the substrate level phosphorylation, or it could be another thing, is that not all mitochondria are damaged. So it's not 100% of mitochondria are damaged. There's a ton of mitochondria in cells.
Yeah.
So it could be the like remaining healthy ones are picking up the slack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it could be either one of those.
Yeah, so this substrate level phosphorylation doesn't need a functioning electron transport chain. All it needs is an inner mitochondrial space and enzymes for the citric acid cycle or the TCA cycle. If you want to learn more about the electron transport chain, by the way, you can check out our podcast on CoQ10. We go through all that in detail. It's way too much to go over now, but it is very interesting to me. And I think probably to some people who listen to this. So a mitochondria that is dysfunctional will still have the space and parts to do the substrate level phosphorylation, even if it's not, you know, 100% functional. These substrate level reactions will still produce the byproducts of the citric acid cycle, like CO2, and this is used as evidence by people to say that cancer cells have functional mitochondria. However, like I said, Thomas Seyfried is saying that data showing that cancer cells have mitochondria that can perform respiration fine are really just a mirage, like a false positive. It's showing substrate level phosphorylation, not functional mitochondria. And here's a quote about that. So, quote, Winehouse assumed that oxygen consumption and CO2 production, which again, those are products of the citric acid cycle, were indicative of coupled respiration. However, excessive amounts of ATP would be produced if elevated glycolysis were expressed together with coupled respiration. Accumulation of ATP will induce cell swelling and produce a physiological state beyond the Gibbs-Donnan equilibrium. And again, that's that negative 56 number. The occurrence of upregulated glycolysis together with normal coupled respiration is incompatible with metabolic homeostasis and cell viability. Chance and Hess also argued against impaired respiration in cancer cells based on their spectrophotometric studies showing mostly normal electron transfer in ascites tumor cells. Don't know if I pronounced that right. These studies, however, failed to assess the level of ATP production as a consequence of normal electron transfer and did not exclude the possibility of elevated ATP production through TCA cycle substrate level phosphorylation. As discussed below, mitochondrial uncoupling can give the false impression of functional respiratory capacity. End quote. And honestly, this is a huge point, and I had like an aha moment when I read this. The cell can't produce the same or adequate amount of energy through normal respiration in the presence of elevated glycolysis because the cell would produce too much energy, and that's a problem. This leads to cell death just as much as too little energy does. And I think that's and I guess I thought of you too when this happened. That's like, 56 is the number. It's not like we can produce 100 and still be cool. 100 is a problem as well.
Yeah, because that's going to, if you're producing too much energy, the production of energy at any cost is going to create reactive oxygen species. And that will be an issue. You're going to have a lot of damage coming as a result of that. So your body doesn't want to be producing too much energy either.
Yeah. So people who argue that no, there's normal respiration and elevated glycolysis in cancer cells. Like, you do not have a basic understanding of just the cell, like what it takes for a cell to live. If that was true, if we had normal respiration, which means functional mitochondria and elevated glycolysis, the cell would produce so much damn energy, it would kill itself. So it can't be a thing.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Like, yeah, it can't have healthy mitochondria
both
and use glycolysis.
Yeah.
It'd be doing one or the other. If the mitochondria were healthy, it wouldn't be relying on glycolysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that's a great point. I didn't really realize that until like you came up with this study. Like, I've never thought of it like that.
Me either. But it's honestly brilliant. And it's obviously a point from Thomas Seyfried. And I was like, and if you should definitely, maybe I'll link a podcast he's done like on our website post because you should hear him talk. Like, if you want to be convinced about this shit, listen to that guy, you know?
He is extremely confident in what he believes in. And honestly, the more and more I research into it, it's like, yeah, he should be.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, 100%. So like I talked about earlier, our body has a process called apoptosis that normally kills cells that aren't working optimally. Old busted cells get neatly and quickly packaged up into their component parts and recycled. But cancer cells avoid this fate, pretty much turning them immortal. So since the cancer cells are able to maintain the base level of energy needed to live, they avoid the normal apoptotic cues that would kill most damaged cells. And here's a quote outlining that, quote, numerous findings indicate that the genes and signaling pathways needed to upregulate and sustain substrate-level phosphorylation are themselves anti-apoptotic. For example, sustained glycolysis requires participation of mTOR and the IGF-1, P13K, AKT signaling pathways. The upregulation of these genes and pathways together with inactivation of tumor-suppressive genes like P53, which is required to initiate apoptosis, will disengage the apoptotic signaling cascade, thus preventing programmed cell death. Tumor cells will continue to evade apoptosis as long as they have access to glucose and glutamine, which are required to maintain substrate-level phosphorylation. End quote. So again, it's back to the energy these cells have access to. We have to cut off their food supply if we want to kill these cells. It really, that's the basis of this whole argument.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, we're always going to have glucose around. So we can limit the glucose, but unless we want to go into a coma, you can't really completely cut it off. And glutamine, you're always going to have glutamine same thing around too. Yeah. And glutamine, other than just being a substrate, it also has another protective factor when it comes to especially cancer cells. So glutamine, like, our body uses it for so many different things. One thing that we use it for is we make glutathione and superoxide dismutase. Those are two of the most potent antioxidants in the body, especially when it comes to, at the cellular level, dealing with reactive oxygen species created by something like glycolysis. So when the cell takes in even more glutamine, it's actually acting as a protective factor because it's creating more glutathione and superoxide dismutase. So it's better able to handle all those extra free radicals. So glutamine is like another double whammy. It sucks that these cells are able to take in so much glutamine.
Yeah, so the cancer cells are able to use the glutamine for two things. For fuel, to stay alive, and as a protective agent, yes, to stay alive.
Yeah.
So they're never dying.
No. Exactly. Yeah, it sucks. Like, they're protective, and they're fueling it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really bad. But unfortunately, there's really no healthy way to limit glutamine. There are... So Seyfried recommends like a blocker, like he does like a pulse on it. Mm-hmm. Like, so you take it one day and then you go off of it and then you like take it in bursts like that. Because yeah, we need antioxidants like glutathione. Our healthy cells need it.
100%.
I mean, like, if you don't have that glutathione in your healthy cells, those healthy cells are going to become dysfunctional and they might become cancerous too.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, so like, yeah, you can't go, I mean, that's like the whole chemotherapy route.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so you can't just be eliminating glutamine altogether. So yeah, there is a smart way to play with it, and he does have a very smart way to do it.
He does, yeah. So at this point, I kind of want to pivot from the glutamine conversation. So just so you know, you can't just cut sugar to zero and then expect to live forever. You know, the cancer cells can use other things for fuel. And but I want to poke a few holes.
Well, before we move on, like, yeah, cancer cells can use more than just glucose and glutamine. But the only reason we're focused on those is because those are the only ones that are abundant enough in the body for them to use. Like, they can use other things to ferment as well, but it's just, like, there's not enough of them around to really make a difference.
Even, worth talking about right now. Yeah. Yeah. Again, don't send me weird emails about these little things, okay? We know.
We're
okay?
Aware. We just don't want to make this a 10-part exactly, 10-part episode, yeah, instead of a 2.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wanted to poke a few holes in the gene theory of cancer. If you really look into the gene theory of cancer, it focuses on finding mutations in the nucleus and fixing those mutations. But here's the problem with that. Even within one type of cancer, each cell can and will have separate gene mutations. So let's say someone has liver cancer and they get a biopsy to look at the genetic mutations to build some sort of drug that specifically targets those mutations, which is a thing, you know, it's gene therapy. That drug will only work on that one cell. Because if you did a biopsy on a different location of the same cancerous liver, that cell would come back with a different set of gene mutations. So not every cell in a tumor has the same gene mutations. That's why, like Tom said earlier, looking for a pattern with these gene mutations is pointless because it changes from cell to cell. And here's a quote about that. Quote, even different tumors within the same cancer type could appear to represent different diseases when evaluated at the genomic level. Pretty much saying not every cancer has the exact same mutations. When evaluated at the metabolic level, however, most cancers and tumors are alike in expressing mitochondrial dysfunction and elevated substrate level phosphorylation. Emerging evidence suggests that mitochondrial dysfunction underlies the mutator phenotype of tumor cells. End quote. So boom, that's pretty much what we're talking about. The mutations change from cancer to cancer and cell to cell. But what doesn't change is a mitochondrial dysfunction. That is the same in all cancers.
You would think that if there was so much difference when we're only looking at it from like the genetic standpoint, we wouldn't call them all cancer. Because there's so much difference at the genetic standpoint. They should all be different diseases.
Yeah.
But since we recognize them as one disease, they should have some sort of similarities here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are none from the gene perspective. So why do they consider it the same thing? They should have thousands or millions of different names for all these cancers.
But from a metabolic standpoint, there is a throughput.
Yeah, and that's why we all call them cancer.
Yep, exactly. So something, obviously, if you listen to this podcast in the past, me and Tom both, we always talk about increasing the health of our mitochondria. So how important are healthy mitochondria really? So healthy mitochondria can prevent a cell from turning cancerous. Quote, there's a quote talking about that. Quote, it is expected that the presence of normal mitochondria in tumor cells would restore the cellular redox status and turn off the retrograde response and reduce or eliminate the need for glycolysis and glutaminolysis to maintain viability. In other words, normal mitochondrial function would facilitate expression of the differentiated state, thereby suppressing the tumorigenic or undifferentiated state, end quote. So that's a powerful quote right there. Our mitochondria control the health of our cells.
You have healthy mitochondria, you don't get cancer. I mean, it's that simple. You don't get that retrograde response leading to cancer.
That's it. So basically, what that says, if you transfer the cytoplasm, which contains mitochondria from a healthy cell, into a cancer cell, that cancer cell will heal itself, which is extremely powerful. However, it doesn't go the other way around. If you transfer the cytoplasm from a cancer cell to a healthy cell with a healthy nucleus, that cell will turn cancerous. And here's a quote. It is also well documented that nuclei from cancer cells can be reprogrammed to form normal tissues when transplanted into normal cytoplasm, despite the continued presence of tumor-associated genomic defects in the cells of the derived tissues. These findings indicate that nuclear gene mutations alone cannot account for the origin of cancer and further highlight the dynamic role of mitochondria in epigenetic regulation of carcinogenesis, end quote.
You're saying that if the nucleus is damaged and that contains all these bad genetics, these cancer-causing genetics, you put that evil cancerous nuclei into a healthy cell, the cell remains healthy. But if you take the damaged mitochondria, the cancerous mitochondria, you put that in a healthy cell.
With the healthy nucleus.
Yeah. That cell does become cancerous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the mitochondria, it's not the nuclei. It's a metabolic disease. It's not a genomic disease.
Thank you. Thank you for wording it that way. That's pretty much exactly what it is. Because that shit is complicated to think about, and it's not very intuitive, but yeah. So now it's finally time to talk about how keto can help with all of this. Because it seems that cancer cells have a decreased ability to burn ketones as fuel. And so let's just do a quick breakdown of ketosis because I know people are confused about that. We have, obviously, at this point, 100 podcasts on ketosis, so just go back and listen to those if you want to learn more about it. But we produce ketones from the fat we eat. Something I like to say, it's a spillover of the acetyl-CoA pool. The major ketone body produces beta-hydroxybutyrate. This is essentially two acetoacetates jammed together. The first step in breaking down these ketone bodies is breaking down the two acetoacetates through a coenzyme A transferase enzyme. And it seems like this enzyme is lacking in tumor cells. So here's a quote talking about that. Quote, tumors contain low or non-detectable levels of transferase activity comparable with that of normal liver. The results indicate that tumors may be unable to metabolize ketone bodies and suggest a therapeutic strategy for selective starvation of the tumor by dietary modification, end quote. So this is obviously the reason why ketosis is so good for cancer treatment. Ketones can be used by healthy cells and not used effectively by cancer cells. And are there studies showing that the keto diet can help cancer? Yes, there are, 100%. Here's a quote about that. The results indicate that the ketogenic diet has an anti-tumor and anti-angiogenetic effect in experimental mouse and human brain tumors when administered in restrictive amounts. A dependency on glucose for energy, together with defects in ketone body metabolism, largely account for why the brain tumors grow minimally on a ketogenic restricted diet, end quote. That's the gist of it right there. Cut the sugar, give your body more access to ketone bodies. Cancer cells hate that shit, and they don't grow.
You're limiting the fuel for cancer cells while providing a very healthy fuel source for all your healthy cells. It's perfect. That's exactly what you want to be going on.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the goal of the keto diet is to keep your carbs low and to lower the amount of glucose available to the cancer cell. How would that help fight cancer? So here's a quote. Quote, reduced glucose availability will target aerobic glycolysis and the pentose phosphate shunt pathways required for the survival and proliferation of many types of tumor cells. Dietary energy restriction specifically targets the IGF-1, P13K, AKT, HIF-1 alpha signaling pathway, which underlies several cancer hallmarks to include cell proliferation, evasion of apoptosis, and angiogenesis. Fats, and especially ketone bodies, can replace glucose as a primary metabolic fuel under calorie restriction. Many tumors have abnormalities in the genes and enzymes needed to metabolize ketone bodies for energy. A transition from carbohydrates to ketones for energy is a simple way to target energy metabolism in glycolysis-dependent tumor cells while enhancing the metabolic efficiency of normal cells. End quote. So cancer doesn't have to be this like big scary disease that strikes without warning or indiscriminately. It has an origin and it's metabolic dysfunction. Fix your metabolism following a properly formulated ketogenic diet and your odds of getting cancer will be greatly reduced. And I want to end just real quick from my quotes, at least, just talking about you don't have to be scared of cancer. You really don't. Here's a quote. Hence, simply reducing exposure to cancer risk factors, which produce chronic inflammation and mitochondrial damage, will reduce the incidence of at least 80% of all cancers. In principle, there are few chronic diseases more easily preventable than cancer. End quote. And I think that that was such a powerful like little quote when I read that because, like I said, it's just everyone is so scared of cancer. And I don't think, you know, we talk about it all the time. You protect your mitochondria and you will be healthy your entire life. You know, there's just the odds are in your favor, you know?
Yeah, it's like your mitochondria they're attached to every single metabolic disease, which is pretty much every single chronic disease.
Yeah.
Like that's the key. Keep your mitochondria healthy and you'll remain healthy.
Yeah.
Like that is the key to life.
And what we've talked about the last, I don't know how many, 5, 6, 7 weeks now with the keto diet, it produces a state which protects our mitochondria and keeps them healthy. It upregulates antioxidants. It decreases the amount of harmful byproducts like just produced by our body. It's just, it's the ideal way our body was designed to run. It just was.
Yeah, so we wanted to kind of end this podcast on a high note because that was a lot of depressing stuff and a lot of like in-depth material.
Yeah.
Hopefully we didn't lose you by now. So we just want to have, like, these are our tips for preventing cancer, or if you do have cancer, this is like kind of like lifestyle changes you might want to introduce. So like we've been talking about, follow a ketogenic or a low carb diet. So right there off the bat, that's going to limit the amount of glucose in your body, limit the fuel source for cancer, while giving your body a nice healthy fuel source for all your healthy cells. So daily intermittent fasting. So this would be one meal a day or eating within like a 6-hour window, something along those lines. So again, you're limiting the amount of glucose in your body with doing that intermittent fasting. And then you're also going to be doing some more autophagy, that's cellular repair, breaking down old damaged cells. You're going to be lowering the IGF-1, the mTOR pathways when you're doing that. So your body's going to be doing more repair.
Yeah, something you might want to touch on this a little bit. We talked about this with the cleaner fuel source, carbs and fats. So obviously you want more details, look in that podcast. But a lot of these research papers just love caloric restriction for like longevity. And when, if you really read them through the lenses we have, what they're really talking about is they're reducing the amount of glycolysis occurring.
Yes.
Not necessarily the calories reduced. That's how toxic glycolysis is. That's what we're talking about. So daily intermittent fasting, you're decreasing the amount of glycolysis you're exposing your body to.
Yeah, because when we do talk about those studies, it shows that daily intermittent fasting has the same effect as caloric restriction. So it's not about reducing your calories total during the day. You could also do it by reducing the amount of time you're consuming those calories. So there's two different ways to play with it. One's going to lead to malnutrition, the other one won't.
And hunger and Lord knows what else.
Yeah, so daily intermittent fasting. So this is another one that's going to be doing the same thing. Exercise, especially while you're fasting. You're going to lower your blood glucose even lower. You're going to be increasing the amount of autophagy. So getting rid of all those damaged cells. Making your body do repair. Extended fasting. At least once a year. An extended fast is 3+ days. If you can make it 7 days, great. If you can't do a 7-day fast, maybe do like 2 or 3, maybe even 4, 3+ day fast throughout the year. I try to do several throughout the year. I'll just kind of just find a day. It's like, you know what? I just feel like fasting. I'm going to do. So far this year, I've done a 5-day fast and a 3-day fast.
You do more than most. Yeah. We're barely in March.
I did a 5-day one to start off the year. I did a 3-day one about a month ago. I'll just do them whenever I feel right. And
I'm the same way. Whenever I get, for whatever reason, maybe we're similar in this sense, I don't know, but I'll just get the desire. Like, I'm going to fast for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah. It's like a nice little challenge, and I don't know, it's just...
Yeah, it just happens.
I kind of like doing it, especially if I'm like really busy. It's like, you know, I don't have time to cook. I don't have time to clean. Yeah. I don't have time to go to the grocery store.
Think of the money you save.
Yeah, that's true too.
Yeah, so that's definitely that's probably one of the bigger ones. People, I mean, it's real hard to fast if you're following a high carb diet. Like, if you're following a standard American diet, good luck doing a 5-day fast. I mean, you definitely can do it. You're not going to die. You might feel like you're going to die, but you're not. But first, start a ketogenic diet, and then try your damnedest, man. Get a 5-day fast in once a year, and George, when you're 85, you'll appreciate it.
Yeah, like, you're going to be doing more and more autophagy doing that. I mean, the daily intermittent fasting, that's kind of like the step one. You're going to be doing a little bit of autophagy with that. You exercise, especially while you're fasting, that's even greater autophagy. Now, you're in an extended fast, and you introduce exercise on top of that, man, you're talking about autophagy kicked into high gear. Like, yeah. It's not going to get any better than that. You're going to be, your glucose levels are going to be extremely low. Your body's going to be saving that glucose for stuff that really matters, like your brain. And maybe those cancer cells are not going to be fueled as much because your body's got bigger priorities.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of that going on.
And when he says autophagy, I think we probably explained it earlier, but just to touch on it again, that gives your body a chance to actually go through and find out what cells are dysfunctional or what cells are kind of looking dysfunctional. So the cells that are almost cancerous and the cells that have the capacity to become cancer, our body sees them and goes, oh, this guy's not working properly. It breaks down and recycles it before it even has a chance to become cancerous. So that's why autophagy is so important.
And I think, like, those things that we just talked about, those are natural things that would be occurring in any animal, in human history, all throughout the animal kingdom. Like, that's why we don't see like sharks with cancer.
Yeah.
That's why we don't see wolves with cancer, even though we see dogs with high cancer rates. That's why we don't see Inuit with cancer. But we see humans with, or like people following a Western diet, we see them with cancer because they're not following these basic human principles.
It's sad though, because we have to introduce these like supposed techniques to just reintroduce our bodies what it wants to do. Like, normally we would fast 2 or 3 days, probably a month, if we were living like on the North Pole. You know what I'm saying?
Tell your doctor that this is your plan, and he's going to think you're crazy. Yeah. And it's probably going to discourage you from doing it, thinking you're going to die.
I know.
And it's one of the healthiest things you can do.
Yep.
And then the other thing, I mean, this is kind of basic, but like, just limit the amount of toxins that you're exposed to. This is probably the most difficult one because there are toxins all around us.
Everywhere.
I think we have a podcast called Toxins All Around Us.
Because they are all around us.
yeah, but I mean, like, there's stuff like Roundup, which has been linked to cancer. Bayer, I think, who owns... Bayer owned Roundup?
I'm pretty sure it does, yeah.
Yeah, they've had to pay out, I think it's like close to $3 billion in lawsuits from cancer patients being sued by them. Pesticides sprayed on your foods. Sunscreens, a lot of stuff.
Even on your clothes.
Yeah. Oh, pesticides are on your clothes. Yeah. Feminine products as well. Those are going inside your body. That's another area that a lot of women should be like protective about, buying organic feminine products, cleaning products. My resource for just finding out what stuff's good and what stuff isn't, I go to EWG.org. That's Environmental Working Group. They have, it's called Skin Deep, is where you can go for like, they'll show deodorants and just like normal stuff that you're going to be putting on your body, like cleaning products, stuff like that. And just their website in general is a great resource to find out what stuff has toxins in it and what stuff doesn't.
Yeah, for sure.
And then if you want to donate to cancer research, we're going to have 3 links followed on the website. The best one would be foundationformetaboliccancertherapies.com. That one is founded by,
The Tripping Over the Truth guy?
Yeah, the Tripping Over the Truth author, Travis Christofferson.
There you go.
Wow, I can't believe I was blanking.
Yeah, that was going to be on you. I don't remember that. Yeah.
So he set up this foundation. He donates a lot of that money to Thomas Seyfried's research and other research that supports the metabolic cancer therapies. That's why it's called that. So that is a great place to donate money to. Another way you can get money to Thomas Seyfried would be donating to Boston College. That's where he's a professor at. The only problem with donating to Boston College is that they decide what to do with the money, not you. So there's no guarantee that you'll be donating to Thomas Seyfried's research by donating to Boston College. So the Foundation for Metabolic Cancer Therapies.com is a better website to go to. And then we
talk, that money goes to him.
That money is either going to go to him or somebody else doing similar research.
In that field, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one is called codiscovery.org. And this is by Young Hee Ko. We talked about her earlier with the 3BP, what is a targeted drug that is targeting glycolysis, inhibiting glycolysis, so it can't hit that negative 56. So once that energy balance becomes low, those cells die. And it's been extremely effective. It just needs a little bit more funding, more clinical trials, stuff like that.
And a fair shot.
Yeah.
I mean, she got the short end of the stick on every way possible.
Yeah, she's never been in a position to succeed. So that's why she's doing her own thing now. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad. And just she just needs the money to do that research, do those clinical trials. Honestly, I think in our lifetime, this drug that she's creating is going to be the cure to cancer.
I hope you're right.
I think it's just a matter of time.
God, I mean, maybe I'm too damn sinful. I'm getting old. I don't know. But I think you're right. It has a capacity to, but I don't know if it'll ever get enough of a fair shake to do it.
So if it doesn't happen here, it'll happen somewhere like Turkey or somewhere in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And then once there's a cure for cancer in Turkey and you have Americans flying to Turkey to get this treatment or wherever else, and then you have a celebrity that does it and then comes back here and tells everybody, hey, I got cured to cancer and the cure is in Turkey, then pharmaceutical companies are going to be forced to develop it.
Okay. I hope you're right. I really do.
I mean, they're not going to do it out of their own goodwill, but the force of change will come.
Yeah. I hope you're right. Well, all right. Well, that's, that was two podcasts done all on cancer. We definitely are both pro the metabolic theory of cancer. It's just, when you look at the data, when you read these papers, which I obviously have backwards and forwards, and like always, the links are on the website, so please read them if you're interested. It's just, this disease doesn't have to be scary. This disease doesn't have to be a death sentence. It really doesn't, you know? Control your diet, control your lifestyle, and cancer does not have to be part of your future. I don't care about your family history. I don't care if your dad, your mom, your cousin, your sister all died of cancer. That doesn't have to be your fate. Just control your diet, take back your health, and give yourself a fighting chance, man. That's all you can do.
Yeah, I hate the genetic theory because then it just makes it sound like it's not in your control when it totally is. And it's like the genetic theory, like the top researchers in it are just like, you know what? I'm never going to figure this out. Let's just start throwing darts at the dartboard to find a cure and just see what works. Like they're not even really trying to make sense of that theory anymore because it doesn't. But then you have researchers on the other side looking at the metabolic theory and they are passionate that they're right because honestly, odds are that they are right because what they're saying makes sense. And we just went into all the studies behind it of why it makes so much sense.
Exactly. So, all right, there you go. Hope you guys liked it. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, no tip of the week this week because we ended with a bunch of tips of the week. Donate to one of those cancer organizations if you have the money to, and also just take back your life with those lifestyle tips that we gave you. You can find our podcast. Please rate and subscribe on your favorite podcast provider. That's Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or YouTube. We also have a donate button on our page. It's a bright yellow button on TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.